Today we begin our study of Worldview Survey, and this is a search for truth. And the first volume of this is called Weltanschauung, and it means, it's a German word that means worldview. And you'll notice the quotation that I give you from Immanuel Kant, the very first page after the title page, Sapere aude, dare to know. The whole question that is going to consume us is how do we know what we know for the next couple of days? So how do we know what we know? The next question that you have to ask is not only how do we know what we know, but what is knowledge in the first place? So before you even begin to ask how do you know what you know, you have to ask the question, how do I even define this word called knowledge? So my question to you is, what is knowledge?
Oh boy. Understanding or intelligence gained about something, someone, or some object.
That's a pretty good rough and ready definition. Intelligence gained about something, someone, or some object. On page 2 of my chapter on where we are getting into the introduction, beginning the search for truth, the first goal is to define the words knowledge and truth. The second goal is to discover those propositions that we can know for sure. And then the third thing we want to do is state our goal in this study. And have you ever heard the term epistemology?
I have here or there.
Okay, do you know what it means?
No, but I could read it and tell you.
Logia is to study, and the episteme is to know. So it's the study of knowledge. It's the branch of philosophy where you look for the preconditions for knowing. How do you know what you know? It's the branch of philosophy that really justifies most other things that you study in philosophy. And it really, if you know anything about the history of thought, philosophy is really the most fundamental of all the academic disciplines because it justifies all of them. You can't study history unless you have a philosophy of history. And your philosophy of history will, in many respects, determine what you think about historical facts and what you find important and that sort of thing. You can't study science without a philosophy of science. So this idea today that science is all there is, ever was or ever will be in terms of anything valuable is bunk. There's always a philosophy standing behind science. Epistemology is, in my opinion, the toughest of all the branches. Metaphysics is the other branch. Do you have any idea what that means?
Definition.
Metaphysics is the study of reality. Okay, meta, physis, what is beyond nature. The older term is ontology, the study of being. All right, so in the modern world, we say that epistemology must precede ontology because you got to know how you know what you know before you study what you know. And being is what you know. Or what is real, and hopefully you can discover it. And epistemology is how do you know what you know? And then finally, the other branch of philosophy is axiology. You heard of that term? It's the study of values, and the shorter term is ethics. So what are your values, and how do you live? And so that's what philosophy is. It's epistemology, ontology, and ethics. The only other branch sometimes is logic, because logic is the tool of the philosopher. And
you're saying that is the foundation for basically every other discipline?
Yes. What is the definition of knowledge? You gave the definition of a kind of understanding or gaining of intelligence about the world around you, of something, someone, or something, or some being. The standard definition on page 3 is knowledge is justified true belief. This is the very bottom of page 3. They give a definition of knowledge. Justified true belief. Okay. So let's look at those terms. What is belief?
The principles which you adhere your life to.
All right, that's a broad definition of belief. What is the act of belief? When the human mind engages in the act of belief, what is it doing?
It's a choice.
Many people would say it's a choice. Some beliefs, though, were not chosen. Most babies born in this world do not choose to believe that there's an outside world. They just believe it. It's it just imposes itself on them.
It's something that's forced upon them.
Yeah, there's some beliefs that are just we're compelled to believe. And then some beliefs that we choose. So a belief is a positive cognitive attitude towards some proposition or thing. When you believe something, you're just saying, yes, that is real. So when I say, I believe the sky is blue, I have a positive cognitive attitude towards the proposition, the sky is blue. That's what belief is. Now, if you believe something, is it true? Not necessarily. A lot of people today believe that as long as you believe something strong enough, it's true. Why wouldn't you hold to that?
Well, because I could believe that the sky is purple, and I could say the sky is purple when very clearly it's not. But I'm believing that it is, and therefore it is.
Okay, yeah, so we have examples in our life all the time where we can point out a case where we believe something very strongly and it turned out not to be so. The human race once believed that the earth was flat, and it's not. I've been reading or watching videos on flat earth theory. It's making a comeback in some circles. And so on YouTube, they have these videos where people were arguing that the earth is flat. And after I saw one of them, my son Evan was on a trip to Alaska. And right when I finished one of these videos, he landed in Alaska. And I said, you know, you got to call me when you land in Alaska. So he calls me. And it was 10:40 at night for me. It was 6:40 in the evening for him. And he said, yeah, it's 6:40 in the evening, but it looks like it's noon. And I just thought that was really interesting because only on a spherical Earth could that sort of phenomenon be possible, where here I am in Southwest Georgia. It's 10:40. It's pitch black out for me, but it's broad daylight like it's noon for him. And I seem to recall 6:40 for me, and it didn't feel like noon in Southwest Georgia. So the 6:40 for me, and the very fact that you have time zones, is a problem for a flat Earth.
Do they have a way to reconcile that? Have you heard anybody try to?
No. No. The best I could do with a flat Earther when it comes to time zones is maybe given mountain peaks and things like that. The shadow of the sun, you know, there might be longer shadows as the sun is making its circuit across the sky. But we wouldn't expect as many time zones as there are. And we certainly wouldn't expect the 12 o'clock or the 6:40 for me is so drastically different than the 6:40 for people living in Alaska.
There might be slight differences, but not that extreme.
Especially since Evan said the sun never really went down. It was never completely dark the entire time he was there.
Right.
So even at 1 o'clock in the morning, it looked like it was dusk. So So again, the human race once believed that the earth was flat. It's not. The human race once believed that the earth was the center of the universe. It's not. So we have plenty of examples of where people believe something very strongly and extremely sincerely, but it was wrong. So
you're
what?
Go ahead. Belief and truth then are not the same thing.
Right. Belief is a positive cognitive attitude towards something. And if you say, I believe the sky is purple, and you're being sincere about that, then you have a positive cognitive attitude towards the proposition that the sky is purple. But yeah, just because you believe it doesn't make it so. So what is truth? If belief is a positive cognitive attitude towards a proposition, and if believing something doesn't make it true, what is true? What makes a proposition true?
That would then call in the question of evidence, right? Because if it's true, there has to be some way that it is proved to be true.
I don't know if I believe that, because here's a proposition for you. On December the 1st, 1804, Napoleon woke up on the right side of the bed and scratched his head. All right? Now, that proposition is either true or false. By the way, he could have woken up on the right side of the bed and not scratched his head. He could have woken up on the right side of the bed and scratched his head. He could have woken up on the left side of the bed, scratched his head, or not. Or he could have woken up and crawled to the foot of the bed and dismounted the bed from there. But either way, he either did or didn't wake up on the right side of the bed. Now, I have no way of knowing whether that's true. But you see, I can utter true propositions all the time and have absolutely no evidence for them. Right? So truth does not depend on evidence. There are non-evidenced truths that are just out there. If you think about it, every proposition we utter is either true or false. Even if, like I might look at you and say, I'm feeling very sad right now. Okay, that's a proposition about reality, okay, about my feelings. And I'd be lying to you if I said that, right? Because it's not, well, that proposition is false. You see, because I'm not feeling sad right now. So you can utter propositions that are true, but there's absolutely no evidence for their truth at all. Now, the fact that there's no evidence for their truth means that you should suspend belief regarding that proposition because you don't have any evidence.
So belief requires evidence?
Well, belief does not require evidence, but it's your epistemic duty to refrain from belief if there is no evidence. There are people that go around believing things all the time with no evidence.
Right.
Now, sometimes their beliefs just happen to be true, right?
They happen
because it just is. So let's say you have a bunch of people walking around and they're saying, Napoleon really did wake up on the right side of the bed and scratch his head. Well, let's say, hypothetically, that that's true. Well, then there are a bunch of people walking around holding a true proposition, right? But they have no evidence for it. So you can believe true propositions and have no evidence for it and happen to be right about it, but you're just not warranted in holding it.
So truth is self-existent.
I don't know if all truths are self-existent.
So some truths are and some truths aren't.
Some truths might be and some truths aren't. Truth, I would define as a proposition that corresponds to reality. A true proposition, or you can say truth, is a proposition that corresponds to reality. And when we talk about reality, we're talking about the extramental world mostly. And a minute ago, I talked about my feelings, but we're talking about extramental reality. And if you're out to discover the truth, you got to be more interested in what's going on outside of your mind than just what's floating around in here. That's the point of it all. Anybody can sit around and just conjure up their own beliefs and create a coherent network of beliefs. But that doesn't mean that any of the things that they're saying or holding to be the case is the case. So how are we doing? A true proposition doesn't have to comprehend reality. So if I say the moon is a sphere, that's a true proposition. But that doesn't mean I've told you everything about the moon. So truth need not be comprehensive in order to be true. Also, the person uttering the proposition, his stance on things has no bearing on the truth of the proposition. So let's say that I'm a complete imbecile, and I just happen to conjure up the point that the moon is a sphere. Well, I've said something true, even if I'm a complete moron, even if the person uttering the proposition is unreliable. Its truth is not dependent upon the person. Right.
Truth is not dependent.
It's not dependent on the person uttering the proposition. Because remember, belief doesn't determine truth.
Right.
It's reality that determines truth. So anchoring your mind in reality is the most important thing you can do.
Do we have to then define what reality is?
Reality is an intuitive notion. It's hard for me to give a definition of reality. But I think we all intuitively realize that there's a difference between what's going on in my mind and what's going on outside in the outside world. Now, some people want to say that there is no difference between the mental world and the quote-unquote real world. It's all the real world. And so we have movies out there like Total Recall and The Matrix, and all of those movies are trying to get you to see a blurred, they're wanting to blur the distinction between the mental and the real. Okay? And I would say, what I would say about that is, the intuition still stands. And here's one of the reasons I know that there's a big difference between what I think is real and what is real. And that is, I suffer. I mean, if reality is what I want it to be, then why do I suffer? Why do things not always go my way? There's a reality out there impinging itself on me. So I know there are people out there that don't want to go get that test, on whatever. I have a lump in my breast. I don't want to go get tested for it because then I'll discover that I have cancer, and then that means I'll have cancer. Well, you know what? You have the cancer. You either have the cancer or you don't, and you're having it is not dependent upon your discovery of it, but your discovery of it may determine whether you're going to live longer or shorter. So you need to go get that test. But there are a lot of people that don't want to go get the test because they're afraid that all of a sudden their reality will change. Your reality is not changing. It's just your knowledge or perception of reality that's changing. And the very fact that we can have this kind of discussion is proof that the mental, what's going on inside your mind, is distinct from what's going on out there. And so when I talk about the real, I'm talking about the mind-independent world. And so the most important thing a human can do is try to orient themselves towards reality, because that's the only way they can know truth. You can't orient yourself towards reality by thinking, well, there's really no difference between what's out there and what's in here.
Can people, though, manipulate and orientate the world to what's going on mentally and kind of see a different reality? And I mean that by their own, workings in their own cognition, being able to believe that they've changed their own reality.
Then that can work two ways. I think your last statement was getting at the idea that people can so contemplate the world in such a way that they deceive themselves into thinking that the world is a certain way, and they go through life like that. Now, there are only a few people in the world that can do that, and they're all among the very rich. So if you're extremely wealthy, you can so conjure up a reality for yourself, because you have resources to do it, that you are, quote-unquote, living in your own world. Okay.
But that's still there's still in other words a physical requirement to that. It's not something that people can simply manipulate with their mind and create this kind of other reality that they live in.
Right. You can't totally conjure up a reality of your own. You have to. You're always butting up against the laws of physics. So there are limits to what you can do there. I mean, all of us agree that the great thing about the human mind is we can conjure up something in our minds and then make it exist in reality in many cases. For example, John F. Kennedy said in the early 1960s, we want to fly to the moon. We want to take a spacecraft, send it to the moon, and bring humans back safely. Well, he had an idea in his mind, and that was mind-boggling, the idea that we could actually do such a thing. I mean, it's one thing to go in outer space. It's another thing to actually journey to the moon. Well, we made that a reality. But I would say this. In 1955, just because you believe we can go to the moon doesn't mean we can. In fact, in 1969, when the Apollo mission was launched, I would say just because we think we're going there doesn't mean we are. It doesn't become real until it becomes real. So while it's amazing what the human mind can do, we can dream of something and then realize the dream. The very fact that we're making that distinction also further demonstrates the distinction between the mental world and the real world.
So to a certain extent, that reality has its own course, and we are simply going along this course.
Very good. We're surfers on a wave. You know, and you can take your surfboard and go up the wave and down the wave and do spins and all that stuff if you're a good surfer. You can go through the tube, which is a really cool image. I'm not a surfer, but I wish I could. And just see and go through a tube like that. I mean, surfers can do all kinds of things, but they can't really control the wave. They can manipulate things in such a way that they can either enjoy the ride or not. So are you gonna go against the wave? Or are you just gonna get up on your board and ride it? And that's actually a great metaphor for philosophy. A good philosopher wants to ride the wave. He doesn't want to swim against it. And so his goal is to find out what the wave is all about. Understand the wave as best as you can so that you can ride it. Your ride is most smooth and most enjoyable.
Isn't there a pretty popular movement these days, this whole, you know, make your own reality, though? And I think it probably goes back to, you know, people sitting on their own throne, but what I've experienced and heard a lot is that, well, human minds are capable of so much more. We are humans are capable of so much more. We're selling ourselves short by not, you know, fulfilling our fullest potential. And if we could fulfill our fullest potential, then we would be able to change our reality. And you're saying then that that's not possible, that there's a course that reality is set on, and we can not, we have no ability, no capability to change it or alter it whatsoever. We are simply on this course, and we can choose whether it's a smooth ride or whether it's a bumpy one.
I think that, I guess the answer to your question is, when it comes to the macro level, no, I don't think that we can change the fundamental constructs of the universe. And I think that if we did, we'd perish into oblivion. So I don't think that we have that power. I do think that if you want to take the surfboard metaphor, you can extend it out, that the whole human race can so construct a society that we live a certain way. And the way we live sort of becomes our world.
Right.
There's a sense in which human history is in large part determined by the decisions of people. And a lot of it comes out of one person trying to manipulate another, which results in war and death and famine and sometimes the creation of really good government. I mean, the unique things about the United States of America, the unique thing is that our government was based on ideas, not ethnicity. And so we constructed a government, thereby constructing a kind of reality for ourselves. But none of that is to suggest that reality is determined by the human mind. It just means that the human mind is able to know, in this case, the workings of human nature in such a way that it can pass laws that are most conducive to balancing out freedom and responsibility. I mean, that's the key, right? We want to have a free people that can do whatever they want, but not in such a way that they wreak havoc on those around them.
Right. How do we reconcile then the fact that somebody's reality in, say, North Africa is a lot different than my reality? Is reality different for each person, or is it one reality that is true? I mean, again, you probably would have to go and look at the what is fundamental reality versus, I don't know.
Well, a lot of this is determined on worldview, which is what we're getting into. But the African living in a village where he's waking up this morning, or who woke up earlier, because his morning was before ours. He woke up on his morning today, in a grass hut, and he has to go out and eke a living in a way that's much different than us, because the way we eke out a living is we use monetary exchange. We're a service-oriented economy. And so my life looks a lot different than his life, but there is a him that's independent of me. He's just as real as I am. I don't know his name. I don't know how old he is. I don't know what he's all about. But I know, and I do think that if he's human, he has many of the same dreams and hopes that I do. And it's just that he just lives in a different culture than me. But I would make a huge distinction between culture and reality. Every culture is real, but no culture creates reality for people in the sense that, you know, he's dealing with the same laws of physics that I am.
Okay.
He deals with wind, rainfall, sunshine. He has to hunt food to sustain himself. If reality is what you made it to be, then you could just dream up food. And you and I both know you can't do that. And I struggle to get food just as much as he does. It's just that my struggle looks different. Because we have different cultures and we have a different economic system that we're under.
So reality would be, in other words, you both being human require sustenance. So both of you therefore have to acquire food by some means to be able to survive. And that's reality. And reality is if you don't eat, you die. That's reality.
That's a reality. Okay.
Well, the distinction then between reality and culture was something that I wasn't making before. So that's because I don't know. I guess, again, my mind is thinking, what do we define as reality then? Is it, again, the fundamental principles, or is it something a little bit less than that, which would be, you know, cultural or situational or...
Well, I'll go ahead and just sort of repeat myself. Culture doesn't determine reality, but culture can affect how a person lives his life. But, you know, your culture's not going to create new laws of physics for you.
Right.
So there's certain realities that are just true across the board, if you want to use this sort of language or nomenclature. And then there's certain realities that are only cultural relative. The dollar is my medium of exchange. Bartering might be the medium of exchange for our African friend. But the reality is that someone's going to use, in a human society, some means of exchange to get by in life, because you can't deny the fact that humans are social creatures. That's one of the most fundamental things about us. Put a man on a deserted island, he's going to go insane. Put a man in communion with other humans, and his chances of thriving and surviving are far greater. And notice, if I say, well, reality is determined by my mind, I can basically just do away with that African guy across the sea. and not learn from him. You know, because I can just say, well, I choose not to think that he's real. And I think most of us would say, well, that's a little bit myopic. That's a little bit more, a little self-centered. So the philosophy that I'm just trying to convey to you, this, there is a distinction between what is going on in my mind and what's going on out there, is an incredibly important one. I think our culture is losing that. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people want us to say, well, if I feel that something is the case, then it is the case. But I find that to be extremely problematic. At some point, you're going to be running up against your biology or the laws of physics. You're going to be butting heads with it, and you're going to be very unhappy. All right, so justification is the last point, but just to review, belief is a positive cognitive attitude towards a proposition, and a proposition is true just in case it corresponds to reality. But just because you believe it, and just because it is true, doesn't mean you know it. There's one last component to knowledge, and that is justification. And just to give you an illustration of how you can believe something, it be true, and you still not know it. Have you ever taken a test where you guessed at all the answers, and yet you still got like a 100 or something?
Maybe not a 100, but yes.
Yeah, we've all taken tests where we didn't really study that hard. We went in because we thought it might be an easy test, and we looked at it, and we were like, oh, sweet Moses. And we guessed at all of the answers. They were multiple choice, say. We didn't know any of them, but we guessed, and we still passed or maybe even luckily got a 100. When I was a sophomore, I didn't study at all for a geometry test, didn't know the material at all, and got a 100. Now, that didn't happen often. That's a very rare thing for me. And I was very, and it was one of the worst things to happen to me. It was early in the year, and as we went on in the course and it got harder, I started doing worse and worse. But you can't say that I knew the material on that test, even though I believed that this should be the right answer, and the right answers ended up being the right answers. I mean, they ended up being true. That doesn't mean that I knew it. So you can believe something, it be true, and not know it. For example, you can believe that Napoleon woke up on December the 1st on the right side of the bed in 1804. But that doesn't mean you know it, even if the proposition is true. So you need justification. Justification is really it's hard to define justification, but we usually give synonyms for the term justification in this context. We say there's warrant for the proposition, or there's good evidence for the proposition. Or there are good reasons, or there's a good argument for this proposition. All right, how are we doing? Good. That's it. That is our study of the definition of knowledge. Any questions about the definition of knowledge?
Well, I may be asking a question shortly, but I'm looking at justification, warrant, good evidence, good argument. So then,
we're about to actually explicate what justifying a truth claim entails.
What good evidence is.
What good evidence is.
Okay.
All right, but that's... I mean, that's the definition of knowledge. Now we have to ask ourselves, and this is where we lead into part two, justifying our truth claims. How do you justify any claim that you make about the world? So what I do here on page 9 is I get into two theories of how we justify our truth claims. And what this involves is the structure of knowledge. How do you structure your knowledge claims? And I think this is an easy question to answer. This is actually one of the easier things you have to deal with in epistemology. It's the source of knowledge that becomes a little tricky. But the structuring of knowledge is actually quite easy. But there are two options that are usually given today. One is coherentism, and the other is foundationalism. And I am a foundationalist. I am not a coherentist. But here's a definition of coherentism given by Alan White. According to the coherentist theory, to say that a statement, usually called a judgment, is true or false is to say that it coheres or fails to cohere with a system of other statements, that it is a member of a system whose elements are related to each other by ties of logical implication, as the elements in a system of pure mathematics are related. Many proponents of the theory hold, indeed, that each member of the system implies every other member. So, how do I know that a statement is true? Because it's part of an overall system of reality, an overall system of belief, and there's an internal coherence to it such that it just shows itself to be true. That's coherentism.
Where did the system come from? How is it?
Well, the system is the system of your mind.
Okay.
So what perspective should I have on the world? I should have the most coherent one. And when I reach that system that is most coherent, then I've reached the true system.
But isn't that going to be then different for every person?
Yes, and that's the problem with coherentism. The problem with coherentism is that it doesn't help you adjudicate competing truth claims that are equally coherent. So, for example, is the debate between the Copernican system and the Ptolemaic system. Now, what are those? Well, these were the systems of cosmology that were developed in the Middle Ages and early Renaissance period and scientific revolution, of course. So Ptolemy said that the Earth is the center of the universe, and all the planets, the sun, the moon, all the stars, they revolve around it. Now, that's a perfectly coherent system of reality. There's nothing illogical or contradictory about it. There's nothing illogical or contradictory about the statement that the Earth is flat and that the sun goes around it. It's not illogical in the sense that I've committed no logical contradiction. Now, some you might say, well, what's wrong with it? I would say it's not true. It's not true because it doesn't correspond to reality. But it's not illogical. I could say unicorns exist. Well, there's nothing illogical about a unicorn, a horse that flies with one horn on its head. Kind of cool. There's nothing illogical about Thor. That's why we can actually watch movies and enjoy them, because they have a kind of coherence to them. If there's incoherence in the movie, you're not going to enjoy it because it disrupts the story. This is why a lot of us don't like sequels, when they get a new person to play a character, because it destroys the continuity between the sequels, mm-hmm. between sequel and the new movie, mm-hmm. or I'm sorry, the prequel and the sequel. There's no continuity between them, and that's why we don't like it. And we only forgive certain franchises for changing actors, like the James Bond franchise. We'll forgive them, because we want James Bond to go on forever. And Sean Connery can't be James Bond forever, so we'll forgive them. But we're not going to forgive Marvel if in Infinity War that's coming out next year, they fire Robert Downey Jr. and give us a new Tony Stark. That just would not be kosher. We would not like that. It would destroy the continuity. So as long as you come up with a coherent story, we enjoy the movie. But that doesn't mean that Thor exists, or that there is a group of people called the Avengers who save New York City from the Chitauri. Or that doesn't mean that in reality, in a galaxy far, far away a long time ago, a guy named Luke Skywalker reconciled his father to the Force.
It's not illogical.
It's not illogical. Now, we would all say that the Star Wars universe is physically impossible, because you can't live on a planet that orbits two suns. You just can't. you will burn up. Nor can you have a weapon that is a laser that just arbitrarily stops mid-space that you could use to deflect other blaster fire. And you that the lightsaber defies the laws of physics. I want a lightsaber. It's the coolest weapon, in my opinion, ever. But it's not going to happen. It just isn't, because the laws of physics just keep it from happening. And the reason I'm a Copernican and not a Ptolemaic is because Ptolemy's system, coherent as it isn't true. By the way, here's an argument against Ptolemy, and this shows you how systems work. Mars is sometimes closer to the Earth at certain times of the year than in others. So the question became, if Mars is orbiting the Earth in a perfect circle, how is that possible? And so the Ptolemaic cosmologists in the Middle Ages said, well, not only is Mars going around the Earth, it's going around something else. And so they ended up creating this very complex system where you had all these epicycles. While all these heavenly bodies are going around the Earth, they were also going around other things. Now, what were they doing? They were saving the system. They were saving the coherence of the system. Okay?
So they created something to save the system.
Well, they hypothesized something to save the system. Now, Copernicus, when he proposed his idea, didn't really have a whole lot of evidence for it. He read ancient Greek philosophers, many of whom had said the Earth goes around the sun. But he didn't have actual physical evidence for this. But what he had was simplicity. He said, it's just so much simpler if we put the sun in the center and say the Earth goes around the sun. Just it's easier that way. And of course he waited till after his death to have this thing published because he was afraid that, you know, he might get in trouble with the church or something. Right? But what did we do? We ended up empirically verifying what Copernicus was saying. And the people that did that would be people like Kepler and then especially Galileo. Who used the telescope and saw that this idea that the Earth is moving is far more plausible than the idea that it's stationary. So how are we doing? By the way, this is actually one of the biggest problems in debate. Sometimes you'll end up having two people with two coherent systems battling each other. And what's really lacking among the two of them is a lack of knowledge concerning certain facts. So if you just knew more facts, you might be able to break the tie. But until more facts come into play, you're not going to be able to do it. And there's some people who are so tied to their system that their system is going to trump any fact. And that's actually one of the most important things you can't do. You can't have a system that is always having to explain away the facts. Eventually, you're going to have to break. You know, if one or two facts come your way and you can't explain them given your system, it's not irrational for you to put them on the back burner, right? And go, well, I really don't know how to do with this, because you know there may be a discovery or a theory that comes along later that kind of reconciles the fact of the theory. But if you got like 1,000 things that your theory can't explain, then it might be time for you to give up your theory. All right, so I'm not a coherentist. So what am I? I'm a foundationalist. On page 9, foundationalism is very simple. A foundationalist says that a proposition is known, that is, it is justifiably true, and therefore you should believe it. It is known if either A, it is self-evident, or B, it is logically entailed by that which is self-evident.
Can you define self-evidence?
Yes. Self-evident is what we need to define. And then I go on to say this. Self-evident beliefs are those which carry within themselves their own evidence and are hence undeniable. In a word, a belief that is self-evident is properly basic. It is properly basic. Some self-evident beliefs are incorrigible or undeniable, like triangles have three sides. That's just analytically true, right? Mm-hmm. While others are simply evident to the senses, I see a blue sky. While it is logically possible to do so, it is difficult to deny propositions that are evident to the senses. Generally, we assume the principle of credulity, that is, sense perception is deemed innocent until proven guilty. Okay, how are we doing?
Good. Generally, we assume the principle of credulity, that is, sense perception is deemed innocent until proven guilty.
So I'm walking down a railroad. I'm looking down the railroad tracks. What do they look like? The railroad tracks. What happens if I look further down?
Look endless.
Sometimes they look endless, and sometimes they look like they converge. At least to me. Or I'm driving in a car and I look out the window in front of me and it's on a hot day. And what do I see maybe 100 yards in front of me?
Water.
Okay. When I was a kid, I used to go, Dad, let's go through that water. And then we'd get there and there was no water. And then I'd look ahead and it was still there. I was like, where's that water coming from? He's like, what water? What are you talking about? It looked to me like there was a puddle of water on the road just way up. Well, those are cases where sense perception has deceived me. Okay? I'm experiencing an illusion, something illusory. But notice that sense perception also corrects it. So when I get up to the illusion, my senses actually readjust and they tell me. So unless I have good reason to believe that my senses have deceived me, like in the case of the water or the converging tracks, you know, I keep walking down that railroad and they don't ever converge. Unless I have good reason to think that my senses have deceived me, I'm just going to believe what I see.
But can our senses be deceived without us having knowledge that they're being deceived?
Yes, they can. They can. But what choice do I have under such conditions? Let's say that we're in the matrix.
Yeah, you don't have one.
Let's say that I'm in the matrix. You and I are both in the matrix.
Okay.
So we're not really here. We're actually part of a computer construct. You and I are actually in pods. And we have a device in our head stimulating our minds to create the illusion that we're actually here in this room having this discussion. Well, until you give me good reasons to think that that is the case, could be the case, but until you give me good reasons to think that that is the case, I'm going to go on believing that, no, you and I are really here. We are not really in pods and all of that. So, I mean, there are all kinds of beliefs that I can't prove. I can't prove that you and I have been sitting here having this discussion for more than 5 minutes. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute. My cell phone that this is being recorded on says 48 minutes and counting that you've been talking. Yeah, but see, God could have created the universe 5 minutes ago and given us built-in memories and false histories. Now notice that any argument you give me at that point is going to be falsified by, well, God just created that along with everything else. You can bring me to your house and show me pictures of you growing up. No, God gave you not only false memories, but, you know, he put these pictures around to make you think. Now, until you have evidence that that is the case, I think it's absurd for you to go along in life and just think that you're no older than 5 minutes. I think that you should go along in life believing that, you know, you're as old as you know you are, and that God did not create you 5 minutes ago. Assuming there's a God in the first place to do the creating. How are we doing?
Good. So,
that's the first point. Those are basic beliefs.
So the person that this requires self-evident beliefs. So let's see, are incorrigible, undeniable, while others are simply evident to the senses. So, okay.
I look outside and I see a tree, and I say, there's a tree before me. Or as Roderick Chisholm says, philosopher, I am appeared to truly. Now, that proposition is self-evident to me in the sense that it is just evident to the senses. And unless I think, I have good reason to think that I should doubt my senses in this experience, I'm going to believe that there's a tree there instead of believing it's some sort of an illusion.
What about the person that takes only what their senses can gather as evidence?
That's a different issue. That's called an empiricist. And we're going to get into that. That's the difference between the source of knowledge and the structuring of knowledge. All right, on page 10, I go on to give some other self-evident beliefs. Along with the assumption that sense perception is reliable, classical foundationalists have articulated properly basic beliefs known as first principles of reasoning. Any list of such principles would include, at the very least, the following. The principle of existence, that something exists. Now, do you have a problem with that? You have to exist before you have a problem with that, so I don't think you're going to have a problem with that, right? So being is not non-being. This is the principle of non-contradiction, sometimes known as the principle of contradiction. Two contradictory propositions cannot both be true. That is, they cannot both express reality at the same time and in the same sense.
Can you give an example?
Yeah. I say that you and I are in a small Southwest Georgia town, and you say, no, we're in a very large North Georgia city. Those are two contrary propositions. Now, those are technically contraries. They're not contradictions. A contrary admits of a third option. And a third option would be, no, we're in an East Georgia town. Another option would be others. But clearly, you and I cannot both be right. To be more explicitly contradictory, I say to you, I am wearing a blue shirt. And you say, you are not wearing a blue shirt. Well, that's a contradiction. There's no third option between blue and non-blue.
Okay?
So we can't both be right. And it is also the case that we can't both be wrong. One of us has to be right in this case, and one of us has to be wrong.
Okay.
Turns out that I'm right because I'm wearing a blue shirt, right? But that's the
senses are failing you.
Unless my senses are failing me, exactly. So the law of contradiction is fundamental, and you knew it when you were born into this world. You came into this world. Why did you cry as a baby when you came out of your mother's womb? Because there's a difference between being warm and cold. And as you know, it's 98 degrees in the human body. And when you exited the womb, that temperature dropped from 98 degrees to about 70. And that drop is just too much for a little baby to handle. And that's why you cried. And so right there, you knew the distinction between cold and hot. And so that's just one example of how the law of non-contradiction from birth just kicked in and you cried. What's beyond that? Being is being. Something is itself. That's the principle of identity. The other law is the law of excluded middle. Either A or not A. Two contradictory propositions cannot both be true, and as I said before, they also cannot both be false. So there's no third option between a contradiction. Either one half of the equation is right or the other is. And one is wrong or the other is.
And that's what this is saying.
That's what excluded middle is saying, yes. Excluded middle, all of these laws, if you think about it, are entailed by one another. So if you embrace excluded middle, you're going to have to embrace both identity and non-contradiction, and vice versa. Okay, and then finally, non-being cannot produce being. This is the principle of causality. If pure non-being ever obtained, then there would be nothing right now. Because pure nothing, which, by the way, I just contradicted myself. There's no such thing as a pure nothing. There's just nothing. Nothing is the absence of anything. And therefore, if there was once ever nothing, including onces, then there wouldn't be anything right now. Because nothing doesn't even have potential. Nothing is nothing. And therefore, if there was ever nothing, there wouldn't be a something. Okay, so for every effect, there must be a cause. And usually we say, just in common parlance, in day-to-day reality, we would say every event has to have a cause. All right, if a known proposition is not self-evident, then it's logically entailed by what is self-evident. And on page 11, I give you the rules of inference. So how do you infer non-basic beliefs from basic? You look at various ways of argumentation, either or, modus ponens, and modus tollens are the most basic laws of inference. And I give you examples here. So for either or, either something exists or there is nothing. That's the major premise. It is not the case that there is nothing. In other words, I'm denying one of those disjuncts, and then therefore something exists. The major premise, premise one, is justified by the fact that there is no third alternative to either being or non-being. Now, it is not always the case that our options can be reduced to only two. One cannot say either Buddhism or Hinduism, for many other religious options remain. Hence, even if one were to demonstrate the falsity of Hinduism, one has not thereby established the truth of Buddhism. But our argument does not commit the either-or fallacy. Since something exists and nothing exists exhausts our options, there simply is no third alternative to being or non-being. And if one grants the major premise, then the conclusion automatically follows. Modus ponens means the way of affirmation. And on the argument that I give you here, if there is no God, that's the antecedent, right? Then I am a monkey's uncle. Okay? If there is no God, then I am a monkey's uncle. The I am a monkey's uncle is the then consequent. And so in modus ponens, we affirm the antecedent, there is no God, so that we can affirm the consequent, I am a monkey's uncle. Leaving aside all metaphorical interpretations of the consequent, what are we to think of the argument? It is without a doubt valid. So notice you can have a valid argument that entails a false conclusion. For if the first two premises are true, then the conclusion automatically follows. Notice that in modus ponens, we affirm the antecedent in order to affirm the consequent, but the opposite is not a valid way to argue. So if there is no God, then I'm a monkey's uncle. I am a monkey's uncle, therefore there is no God. That is an invalid way of reasoning. It may very well be the case that I'm a monkey's uncle, and it may very well be the case that there is no God, but the non-existence of God cannot be established in this way. Modus tollens is the way of denial. So if I'm a monkey's uncle, then God exists. The next premise is, God does not exist, therefore I am not a monkey's uncle. This is a valid argument. For if one can show that there is a good and necessary connection between the antecedent and consequent, then the denial of the consequent demands a denial of the antecedent. Hence, if one can establish the truth of 8, then 9 follows. As in modus ponens, the opposite is not true. That is to say, one cannot deny the antecedent in order to deny the consequent, for seven does nothing to refute the notion that I'm a monkey's uncle in a world created by God. All right. That's a quick primer on laws of inference. How are we doing? Yeah. There is a classical syllogism, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. That's another one that's common. And you can actually state that in terms of modus ponens. You can say, if all men are mortal, then Socrates is mortal. I'm sorry, if Socrates is a man, then Socrates is mortal. And Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. That's a modus ponens argument. So you can actually take arguments and fit them in any style you want. And usually it's the most persuasive style that you want to give to state your argument. The interesting thing is one man's modus tollens is another man's modus ponens. So if I say the following, if God exists, then humans are special. God exists, therefore humans are special. What form am I using right there?
Modus ponens.
I'm using modus ponens. So, but you have to understand, an atheist could come along and say, if God exists, then humans are special. Humans are not special, therefore God does not exist. You see, he's using modus tollens to come to the same conclusion using the same premises. He's just denying them. So he's denying the consequence so he can deny the antecedent. So one man's modus ponens is another man's modus tollens. Your worldview will often determine how you utilize rational inference. And that's why you need to be very careful about what you think is a purely logical proof of what you believe, because a lot of that is worldview dependent. But what can we know for sure? On page 13, I do give a sound argument demonstrating something interesting about the extramental world. And here it is. If non-being ever obtained, then it's not the case that something exists now. But it is the case that something exists now, therefore non-being has never obtained. In other words, again, if there was ever nothingness, then there wouldn't be something right now. But there is something right now. That means that for all eternity, there has to have been something. Now, what that eternal something is, who knows? But it has to be something. There has to be something that is eternal. There has to be something that has always existed. How are we doing? All right, now, the next issue is inductive reasoning. Inductive reasoning reasons from particular observations to general conclusions. Right? So in inductive reasoning, we say, in science, for example, I would say, I see this object fall to the ground 100 times. And I conclude that the 101st time that I release it, it will fall to the ground. And if I see enough observations, I come to a general theory about how the world works. And if it's even more solid than that, I say it's not just a theory, it's a law.
That's deductive?
Or that's inductive.
Inductive.
It's based on experimentation, observation, experimentation, and all of that. So science is grounded in induction. Historical reasoning is inductive in character. If you want to come to a general idea about how a certain society worked, you look at the particular statements, archaeological artifacts, and so forth. You look at all of that, and you come to a general conclusion about how this society worked. So it's inductive in character. Forensics is inductive. So if I want to know, if I conclude that the butler committed the murder, And I give this example on page 15. Where do I start here?
It's last paragraph.
But there might be some things I want to say before that. But I point out that experiments serve as part of the background knowledge for the conclusion. So other elements in our background knowledge when doing inductive research, we would say there's an experimental world. The world of our experience is uniform. The principle of causality is true. So to give one more example of inductive reasoning, the background knowledge we take to it, consider the question of whether the butler committed the murder. The background knowledge we take to such an induction would include the following. There's an external world. The world of our experience is uniform. The principle of causality is true. For example, knives do not simply spontaneously generate in the backs of employers. The butler was in the house between 10 p.m. and 12 a.m. Forensic evidence, like the autopsy, indicates that the victim was murdered anywhere between 10 p.m. and 12 a.m. The butler had a motive to kill the master of the house. The butler's fingerprints were found on the murder weapon. The core events given in the butler's alibi have several versions, each one seeming to contradict the other. The butler has a criminal record as well as a reputation for lying. Okay. Now, what? Given that evidence, what am I going to conclude?
The butler committed the murder.
A second characteristic of inductive reasoning is that its conclusions are merely probable and not certain. So, in a deductive argument, our conclusions are certain. If the premises are true, the conclusion automatically follows, whether you like it or not. But in inductive arguments, the conclusions are probable. So, I would never speak of a sound inductive argument. I only speak of strong inductive arguments. Given the evidence that I just gave you, it is a strong inductive inference that the butler committed the murder. Right? But what if our background knowledge changed? No reasonable jury would consider the following lines of defense, by the way. Martians came down and framed the butler. Or it is logically possible the two different people on this planet have the exact same fingerprints. Or the master of the house accidentally fell on the knife, which happened to be standing in an upright position. Right? So there's certain logical possibilities that you're going to rule out as so improbable that it's not reasonable to consider them. And so we come to a moral certainty that the butler committed the murder, given this background knowledge.
But we come to that by conclusions that are probable.
Yeah.
So we can come to a certainty by conclusions that are probable.
It's a moral certainty based on probabilistic kinds of reasoning. Given this evidence, I am morally certain that the butler committed the murder. I am not mathematically certain, though. I wouldn't say... You know,
can that change though if
yeah.
evidence is later presented and then your moral certainty changes?
Yeah, my certainty changes. So notice, I say this. Our conclusion is highly probable, for it is inductively strong with respect to the background knowledge. But if more background knowledge came into our purview, we might change our conclusion. So the prosecuting attorneys give me all that background knowledge that I just gave you. And you're like, okay, he did it. But then the defense comes up and they say something like the following. 6 months ago, the butler converted to Buddhism and is now gaining a reputation for truth-telling. The butler has a mistress who is also in the house between 10 and 12. It is now known that the butler's mistress hates both the master and the butler. Latex gloves were found buried in the yard. They fit the mistress, but not the butler. The core events recorded in the butler's testimony can be plausibly harmonized. The mistress demonstrates an unusual nervousness while being questioned, while the butler has always been both sad over the death of the master and yet calm in the face of questioning. Now what would you conclude? You might not say that the mistress did it, but you're going to doubt that the butler did it, right? So you're going to question that inductive inference.
So So if that's true, then how can we say that it's a moral certainty? Because if it can change, then how can it be certain? If it has the possibility of changing
because
down the road,
because certainty is a proposition, is a characteristic or property of persons, not evidence. You are led to certainty given certain kinds of evidence. But that doesn't mean that the evidence is certain.
True.
Okay. But it's not irrational for you to come to these moral certainties as long as you're open-minded about new evidence coming in. That's part of the problem with most people. Once they are given one side of an equation, they become very rigid in their desire to look at the other part of the equation. And that's why we have problems, right? By the way, it also is interesting when it comes to campaigns. I mean, last year, before the candidates were chosen, and it was still up in the air as to who was going to get the nomination, I heard people cussing Donald Trump, couldn't stand him, all of that stuff. Same thing about Hillary. Liberals that I knew hated Hillary, wanted Bernie to get it. But then once you came to the conclusion that Donald Trump was the only guy worthy of a vote in the election, it didn't matter what he did after the nomination. It cut no ice. And the same thing for Hillary. Those who got on the Hillary bandwagon early on and said, no matter what she did, no matter how many emails we uncovered and all that, they were still, these people were still defended, you see. But so sometimes some people believe that if you say yes to this, then you almost, it's like you have a moral obligation to stick to it.
Yeah.
And I will grant that, you know, you don't want to be fickle in your convictions. So you don't want to say yes, no, yes, no, and go through life like that. But at the same time, you always have to be willing to let go of your most cherished beliefs if new evidence arises that refutes it.
Interesting.
You always have to be open to do that. So what you want to do is you want to find a philosophy that is fluid enough to accommodate new evidence, but solid enough to be something you can cling to. Here's a summary. We noted that this is on page 17. We noted that the best way to structure our knowledge is foundationalism. That is, we must move from principles that are self-evident to propositions that are not self-evident. First principles give us a way to structure our knowledge, while sense perception gives us the stuff we have to think about. The senses give us access to the outside world. We move from self-evident knowledge to non-self-evident knowledge by using both deductive and inductive reasoning. In fact, many philosophers seem to agree that in our day-to-day lives, we all combine deductive and inductive reasoning into what we might call an abductive way of approaching the world. For example, at a baseball game, the pitcher has studied the players on the other team and knows which ones can and cannot handle a curveball. Thus, he inductively infers that player A, who usually misses curveballs, will probably miss the one he's about to throw to him. And he deductively concludes that if he can make his opponent swing three times and miss, he has struck out his opponent. Notice in all of this that the pitcher's reasoning abductively, for his inductions and deductions are blended together in such a way that it's sometimes hard to tell when one ends and the other begins. Now that leads us to the issue of the source of knowledge. Where does knowledge come from? Okay, and so this little discussion here is where we're gonna finish this, and that'll be the end of our lesson for today. There are three options that you have: mysticism, empiricism, and rationalism. The mystic says that knowledge begins in human feeling. Knowledge is felt or intuited. The mystic just knows that something is the case by feeling or sensing that it is so. How do you know? I just know. I just feel it. Mystics often appeal to testimonies concerning the flashes of insight that were later verified. I have a friend. He's in Ecuador. He witnesses a murder. He's in the woods. He witnesses a mafia-style execution. And he is allowed to go. He thought at one point they were going to kill him too, but because he was an American, he and his girlfriend were able to leave, and they had to walk through those woods listening to a guy they know being tortured to death. While this is going on, his grandmother woke up in the middle of the night, and she said, "There's something wrong with our boy. We need to get in touch with him." People, mystics will appeal to those kinds of experiences as proof that it's really feeling that determines knowledge, not any of this other stuff. Now, my question to you is, does that satisfy you? No. Why?
I don't believe feelings are solid enough to rest the weight of knowledge on them.
Why?
Because they are subjective, because they can change. Yeah, I mean, if we go back to what knowledge is, that justified true belief, well, isn't that going to be justified, or isn't the truth going to be separate from a subjective human feeling?
The subjective human feeling corresponds to the truth that's being expressed. There's something wrong with our boy down there. How do you know? I feel it. I have a premonition. I think you're on the right track, though. I mean, I'm not really, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, because for every person, for every example you can give me of a person that just knew something, they felt it and it became true, I can give you hundreds of people that just felt it and it just wasn't true at all. I have a feeling in my gut that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, they weren't there. And so if you embrace a mystical attitude, chances are, if you become a leader and you think feeling determines truth, then you're gonna put people in harm's way. So I don't think that you can ground knowledge in feeling. Feeling cannot be the source of knowledge.
Simply because it's not consistent?
Feeling is an extremely inconsistent standard of knowledge.
But then how do you reconcile those events where, I mean, do you just say it's chance?
I think you have to explain those in the context of your worldview. So whatever worldview you think is true will be the context whereby you explain those kinds of things.
And so if somebody, that you're saying then if somebody believed in a supernatural being, that supernatural being therefore gave them the knowledge that something was wrong, therefore they felt it.
It may not have to be something that direct. It may be that because, let's say that pantheism is true. Pantheism is the belief that God is everything. Well, if we're all divine, then there may be times in which you feel the connection, especially if it's a relative. Mm-hmm. And so that would be a verification of your pantheism. And so that's how you would explain this. If atheism is true, then they're just dumb coincidences sometimes. Get over it. And I'm not trying to be flippant. I mean, that's how atheists that I meet often think. They just roll their eyes and say, "Look, that." You know, every now and then, somebody's going to land upon some premonition that just justifies itself. You know, how were we trained during the course of evolution? Have you ever just felt like running upstairs because you thought something was watching you? Or something was around the corner. Well, see, your mind was molded by evolution to protect itself, and it's always safer to run than to just sort of sit there and think through the problem. So you're still a product of all that evolutionary history. So, yeah, sometimes you just turn around and run away. And sometimes it turns out that there really was a burglar outside the house watching you, and it was a very good idea for you to run upstairs and shut the door, and then you heard the clanging downstairs, and you called the police. So very good for you. But does that mean that that is a reliable way of knowing? No, that's just a carryover of natural selection. So the next option is empiricism. Knowledge does not begin in feeling, but experience. The empiricist mantra is that nothing was ever in the human mind that was not first in the senses. Empiricists point out all sorts of beliefs. Empiricists point out that all sorts of beliefs are only called knowledge after they have been verified by the senses. Sight, touch, sound, taste, and smell. The testimony of the mystic is not accepted as knowledge until later experience confirms it. So how do we know that the grandmother knew? We know because of later verification through sense experience.
So that's just then from mysticism to empiricism?
Yeah, the empiricist would say, she didn't know that her feeling was true until it was verified by an interview with her grandson. So we don't know things until we fully experience them or sense them or whatever. As we already noted, the basic reliability of sense perception should not be denied by anyone. Philosophers will sometimes point to those occasions when sense perception has let us down. For example, one may observe that the ore in the water looks bent. One may observe that on a hot sunny day on the highway, it looks like water is on the road. One may observe while standing on the train tracks, the tracks meet one another several miles away. But philosophers only know this because other experiences corrected the initial perception. So the basic reliability of sense perception is not invalidated by these experiences. But unfortunately for the empiricists, there are several reasons to think that it is not the case that all knowledge begins in sense perception. First, empiricism defeats itself, for notice what the empiricist is saying. All knowledge begins in sense experience. Did the empiricist have a sense perception of that claim? No. So how does he know this? How do you know that all knowledge begins in sense experience? Have you experienced all things? Second, most empiricists follow Locke and claim that the human mind is a blank slate at birth. The mind is totally blank until a human being begins to have experiences of the world. But if that is true, then how does the mind even begin to interpret the data entering into the human mind? Without something to structure our knowledge claims, it seems that it is impossible for anyone to know anything. Given empiricism, the content delivered to the mind via the senses is just a bunch of uninterpreted sense data. And that leads us to rationalism. Who are the two most famous empiricists? Who are the two most famous philosophers in history? And where do they stand on the empiricist-rationalist debate? Two most famous philosophers in history are?
Socrates.
Yeah, he might be. But then his student was?
Plato.
And his student was? Aristotle.
Aristotle.
Right. Just remember Spa.
Spa.
Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Right? That's an easy way to remember.
Two out of three.
So, Socrates, but he didn't write anything. So Plato was the first systematic philosopher who used Socrates as his hero in most of his dialogues. And then Aristotle was another systematic philosopher, and they were teacher-student. If you look at my favorite Renaissance painting, The School of Athens, you'll see Plato and Aristotle walking in the middle of the painting. And Plato has his finger pointing upwards, and Aristotle's looking at him, and his fingers are spread outward and pointing downwards. Aristotle's the empiricist. He's saying we know through the five senses. That's how we know. And Plato's looking at him saying, "No, my student. True knowledge comes from ideas." He's a rationalist. The rationalist says that all knowledge begins in the mind. For Plato, and we'll talk about him in more detail later, but for Plato, we know all things even before we are born, and that experience is really just bringing that knowledge to our conscious awareness. But whether you're a rationalist like Plato or a rationalist like someone like Descartes or Spinoza or Leibniz or someone like that, you're going to say that knowledge just begins in the human mind, that the human mind already has all it needs to structure our knowledge claims. Since there are obvious problems with the other epistemologies discussed, one would think that rationalism wins by default. Unfortunately, there are several fatal criticisms of rationalism. For example, if all human beings have knowledge at birth, why do we disagree with one another on so many different issues? Spinoza, Descartes, and Leibniz each advocated three different metaphysical views that contradicted each other. But if rationalism were true, we would expect them to have all carried their rationalisms, that's a word, to their logical conclusion, which would have been the same for all of them. Also, our critique of the coherence theory of truth applies here as well, for we know that the human mind can conjure up a number of logical ideas that have no correspondence to reality. When the human mind is entertaining two contradictory ideas, both of which are internally coherent, how does it decide which is true? As strange as it may seem, one will often note a hint of arbitrariness in how rationalists reach their conclusions, which has caused a number of philosophers to call rationalists closet mystics. And that's true. I mean, when Descartes starts off his first meditation in philosophy, he describes a dream he had, and he came to his conclusions through a dream. Well, that's mysticism. So actually, most rationalists end up becoming mystics. So on page 20, we have seen the way to structure human knowledge is easy. Foundational seems to be our only clear option. We must presuppose the first principles of reason as well as the basic reliability of the senses and then establish all truth claims upon this solid foundation. However, establishing the source of knowledge is not so easy. Rationalism, empiricism, and mysticism all seem to be initially plausible, and each has a significant number of holes, rendering each implausible. Unfortunately, our inability to establish a sure source of knowledge renders our otherwise solid structure unsound. For without a sure understanding of where our knowledge comes from, we find ourselves less sure of the validity of any structure that flows from any knowledge. It is even more unfortunate to know that feeling, sense perception, and the brain exhaust all possible modes of knowing that humans have to offer. Therefore, there is no way any human being can be, in and of himself, an adequate source of knowledge. Some may suggest that our only hope is to somehow combine mysticism, empiricism, and rationalism into one broad understanding of where we get our knowledge from. But this suggestion has two problems. First, feeling, mental exertion, and sense perception are clearly different ways of knowing. In fact, they are contradictory. Thus, to combine them into one is impossible. Second, the suggestion commits the leaky bucket fallacy. Indeed, if one has in his possession three buckets with holes in them, his chances of carrying water in them are not increased by putting them together. In the same way, mysticism, rationalism, and empiricism all have holes. Thus, combining them together could never give us a sure or secure source of knowledge. On the other hand, there must be a source of human knowledge, and it must reside in either feeling, mental concept, sense perception, or something altogether different. We have a choice here. Either say that knowledge is impossible or seek a source of knowing. The former is self-defeating, as we have seen, since it makes a knowledge claim. If someone says, no one knows anything, I would say, how do you know that? In which case, he's either just saying something arbitrarily without justification, in which case he doesn't know that, and I can just reject it, or he's defeated himself because he knows it, in which case some people do know some things. Thus, the latter is the only possible path to gain. The only way to take the path in pursuing knowledge is to give up the old Enlightenment dream of establishing a purely autonomous epistemology, a theory of knowledge that is sufficient unto itself. In other words, our epistemology must be linked to an ontology, a theory about reality or a metaphysic. Setting forth a theory of reality consists in coming to terms with the fundamental constituents of being. What is real? There are three metaphysical systems: monism, pluralism, and dualism. The monist says that reality is fundamentally the same. All is one. The pluralist says that reality is fundamentally many. Everything is separate and distinct. The dualist says that reality is fundamentally two, with one reality in some vague sense dependent upon another. These three systems cannot all be true, nor can two of them be true. One must be true and the others must be false. How shall we decide which is true? Before we answer this question directly, the reader should notice that in order to answer the question, one must first establish a way of testing every metaphysical system. And it must be a fair standard. It cannot stack the deck in its favor by appealing to, for example, an ancient authority or holy book. For first, such a procedure begs the question at issue, since those who advocate the other systems will not accept the authority. God exists. How do you know? The Bible says so. Why should I trust the Bible? Because it's the Word of God. That's a circle that is self-defeating. It's a vicious circle. The other problem is that those other systems can merely go ahead and quote their own authorities, thus creating a stalemate that will end in either shouts or silence, created by the sword or the unwillingness to further dialogue. The Quran is the Word of God. How do you know? God inspired it. The Bible is. No, the Quran is. Now we're just shouting at each other. In short, the only way to establish with fairness and or justice one metaphysic is to adopt a set of moral values, an axiology, that render one's test for truth fair or just. So you have to link your ontology with an ethic. One's theory of knowledge, reality, and value just is one's worldview. So what we are looking for is a worldview that can give us an adequate source of knowledge, reality, and value. In other words, we're looking for a worldview that will give us the preconditions for understanding how we know what is real and how we ought to live. One will notice in all of this that philosophy is a package deal. One cannot do epistemology, ethics, or metaphysics in isolation. One will always have to imply the other. There is one simple goal we will try to establish before this work is complete. Namely, we will try to demonstrate in a positive way that a particular metaphysic and worldview is true. But there is more than one worldview, just as there is more than one ontology. The metaphysical theory known as dualism is associated with the school of thought upheld by Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. It is also associated with the thought of the Hebrew prophets, Jesus and his apostles, and as well as the Muslims. Thus, broadly speaking, it is appropriate to ascribe the label theism to those views of reality upholding a dualistic understanding of the world. And as one can immediately infer, there are two kinds of theism: pagan theism of the philosophers like Plato and Aristotle, and Abrahamic theism of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Pantheism is the worldview associated with the monistic metaphysic and seeks to identify God or Brahman or the All with the world. However, some monists see the world as something in process and yet also see God as somehow associated with the processes of the world. These monists are called panentheists or process theists. Atheism is the outlook often associated with a pluralistic view of the world. For example, the ancient philosopher Epicurus argued that all of reality is distinguished into bits of matter he called atoms. Hence, his school of thought, which was explicitly atheistic, is called atomism. Polytheism is also associated with a pluralistic view of the world, at least to the extent that the gods have their limited authority over their respective realms within the world. Agnosticism, the view that teaches that it is impossible to know metaphysical truths, may very well be associated with pluralism too. Indeed, a philosopher who looks upon the world as so confusing that he cannot decide which is true seems to, or decide what is true, seems to presuppose a world made up of bits of matter that are disparate and chaotic. What tests will we employ to discover which of these worldviews is true? In chapter 2, we will seek an answer by building on the insights of this chapter. There we will further refine our understanding of what a worldview is, give a list of the only 6 worldviews humans have ever and can ever contemplate, and offer a test for deciding which worldview is true. The very last thing, the appendix, I basically just give a chart where I distinguish conceiving, judging, and reasoning. Concepts refer to terms, and terms, like the term God, those are either clear or unclear. So you don't say God is true. You say, when you're talking about the term,
right.
You say God is clear or unclear. And then judgments refer to propositions like God exists, and the proposition God exists is either true or false. If true, it is either evident or not evident. If evident, through other propositions or self-evident. If it is self-evident, it is self-evident in itself and to us, or in itself but not to us. In other words, if God exists, he's self-evident to himself. But that doesn't mean that he's self-evident to us. And then through other propositions, deductively or inductively. And then reasoning refers to arguments which are either logically valid or logically invalid. And if they're valid, they are either sound or unsound. So that chart should help you kind of map out everything that we've said.